Fred, before we come to Sydney Harbour and the Sydney Avenue Sailing Club, I've long assumed that you began your illustrious sailing career in Melbourne. Is that the case?
No, I only went sailing once with my father in one of his friend's boats in Melbourne. But my father did sail at Williamstown, things called Williamstown punts. He sailed those in the 1920s, over 100 years ago now. And he was quite good at it. He and his brother used to sail it. I always looked at it and thought, gee, I wish I could have gone sailing, but never did. And only when I got to Sydney, after a couple of years, did I go into a partnership with one of my work colleagues and friends, Alex and Sue Holloway, and we purchased Compass 28, which we had lowered down by crane into his front yard at Kangaroo Point. And it had a walkway to the house. It was a modern sort of house, Japanese style. And this yacht was sitting in there. And his wife was a keen sailor. She came from Tasmania. And it was supposed to be a 2 or 3 year project. But, you know, as you get enthusiastic about these things, the time frame sort of shortened. And we had to get a motor and a mast. And I did the timber work in it.
And were you sailing that before you joined the amateurs?
Yes, well, I was a member at Cronulla Ocean Yacht Club down there, and we sailed for a little bit down there. Sailed it up to Sydney Harbour, had it in Lavender Bay for a while. I hooked up with Beverly. Alex, the partner, had a different direction they were going, so we collectively decided to sell it.
So you joined the amateurs in 1977, 40,
yeah, so this would have been in 75, and then in 76 I got married, and then... And I was walking around the house, you know, on Saturdays without a boat. And Beverly said to me, for God's sake, go and buy another boat and get out of the house. I've had enough of this.
So you bought Brigadoon?
Yes, from Lake Macquarie.
From Lake Macquarie. Why did you join the amateurs?
Well, because I knew Jim Bradshaw. I had flown round Australia with a flatmate, Doug Carlson, and Jim and Jenny Bradshaw, who were members and his father owned a boat at the amateurs, were people that made up the four when we flew to Ayers Rock, Alice Springs, Brampton Island, back to Sydney, you know, a big tour around Australia. When we came back, he took us out sailing once and talked about the amateurs, and that's how I ended up knowing about it.
You were drafted pretty much straight away as treasurer, weren't you?
Well, I turned up...
Or did you volunteer?
Well, I turned up in one of those sort of first night things, was handed a copy of the amateurs book, as everyone was, new members in those days. It was a way of getting rid of them. And Brian Woods, who was Commodore, said, look, our treasurer is needing to stand down for a variety of reasons. If anybody knows, he might be able to help. So I saw him at the end of the meeting. He said, look, you know, I'm in that sort of field, I might be able to help. So he said, look, I'll contact you. He said, can you come and see our auditors, who had the fabulous name of Forge and Forge? So I went and saw the auditors, and Brian introduced me as the new treasurer. And that was it. That was 1977. And
you did, I think, 16 years straight.
Pretty well, in your
first stint.
In the first stint,
And then, surprisingly, perhaps backed up a second time for a few more years.
Yes, for a couple of years, I think, through Charles and Clerken's term. Asked if I would.
When you joined the amateurs, what do you remember of the atmosphere of the place? What were your first impressions?
Oh, it was old world. It had the image of one of what I imagined a yacht club on the east coast of America might have looked like, an Edwardian house. It didn't have a bar. It didn't have a dining room. It was what it was. It was a club where most of the members there were boat owners and sailors.
And what it still is.
And it still is. And that's its great virtue, as far as I can see. And it lived on self-help. You know, it had a modest, tiny turnover in those days, and it was still working through the process of upgrading the building and the slipways. And it was that period where it was just incrementally growing and improving. We weren't probably in those days charging anything near a commercial rate, and gradually manoeuvred that to be a bit more commercial, closer to
the
market.
Was the club ever broke?
No, no, never broke. It issued some debentures and notes to help with the acquisition of the thing, and largely they were never repaid. They were just eventually became donations, and we virtually worked them out of the books over time, you know.
I'd like to look a bit at your boats and your crews, and as a forward to that, note that you've won 6 season gold medals and 2 Kelly Cups, divided 50-50 in both cases between Brigadoon and Warana. That tells me that you know what you're doing on the water. Let's talk about Brigadoon first. She was an Endeavour, 26. How did you get her to win 3 season gold medals and the Kelly Cup?
Persistence, I suppose. Look, I'd never done much sailing. The Endeavour 26s were relatively competitive boats, and in those days there were a lot of production yachts racing, you know, in the 24 to 26 foot length, the Tritons, the Top Hats. And there were some great competitors back. Bill Osling, the Reverend Bill Osling, used to be out. Hal Wise, and then we had Kevin Tindall, Berube. You know, these were all very, very keen sailors. McClurkin would be around in
TV. So it was fairly cutthroat.
Yeah, yeah, but they were keen to win. I had a variety of crew. The first crewman I had was my neighbour, architect. I've been in the same house for 44 years or so, about the length I've been a member of the club. He sailed with me for many, many years until his back wasn't any good anymore. He helped me bring the boat down from Brigadoon, down from Lake Macquarie. We sailed it down the coast. Knew nothing, really.
And did you take that same crew across to Warana?
Some of them. It changed over time, but there's only one that would have been on Brigadoon, and that's Peter Cleland. He was introduced to me through a friend who was sailing on Brigadoon at that stage, and he was a friend of Harvey's. So, you know, it was this network of people that used to come along, and we had Brigadoon moored down near Collingwood Street, near the pub in Hunter's Hill on the corner.
The Lanco River.
Yeah, and Lanco River, just the bars there, you know, down below the pub. And there was a dinghy on the shore, and we'd row out to that. And in those days, there were a stream of boats that would come back out of the Lane Cove River, you know, the Merringtons and some of the Gales and the Stewart Chambers and Phantom.
Well, Warana, of course, was John Merrington's boat.
Yes, he was around the other side, though, of the peninsula. He was on the southern side of the peninsula.
And Warana had a pretty distinguished sailing record before you acquired it. You've kept that going.
It was owned by a bloke called Moore who had it built. According to Bill Gale and to the Merringtons, the two boats built. One was called Monsoon, and Warana was launched as Jolly Breeze.
The New Zealand-built boat?
No, a Hayes-built boat in Sydney. Charlie Peel design, about 31 feet. They weren't absolutely identical. The hulls were identical, but the coach houses were different. Then when Maud died, his widow said that he wanted John Merrington to buy it, and John Merrington bought it. He was, I think at that stage, mayor of Hunter's Hill or something, 1962, 63, somewhere around then. He did a big job in changing it from gaff rig to sloop, put a frame inside to support it as a mast step on the top of the coach house. So that opened up the inside of it, went to a sloop rig, put a lamppost up for a mast, and then sailed it. They used to have a little bars in his house just near the Valencia Street wharf. He converted that into a slipway so he could bring Warana up and work on it and keep it going. So he looked after
it pretty well. You had big shoes to fill when you took it over.
I didn't know how to sail it. It went like a dog. You know, I thought, why have I done this? You know,
that was my... What happened?
Oh, I finally got to know how to sail it, you know.
Did you tweak the boat much, or was it simply a case of learning how to...
No, I didn't tweak the boat, no. There was nothing to tweak. I remember I bought a new sail and Ian McDiamond came out and I said, should we change the angle of the mast? We'll see if... He looked and he said, no, it's a bloody lamppost. It's wasting your time. Yeah, you got to understand that you had to keep it moving coming out of attack if you... lost way, you'd take half an hour before you get going again.
So looking back over 45 years of K competing on Sydney Harbour at the amateurs in Brigadoon and Warada. Regardless of Kelly Cups and gold medals, what for you were the highlights of those long years of sailing?
There are many, of course, but you remember the disasters more than most things.
Was this when you won the T-Bone Trophy?
Oh, that's when I T-boned the Commodore, John Jeremy, before the start of a race, punctured the side of his boat.
It says a lot about the amateur's esprit de corps. This is from the second century begins. Skipper of Brigadoon, John, I seem to have done considerable damage. Skipper of Tingari, that's all right, Fred, but you understand that I'll have to protest you. Skipper of Brigadoon, of course, I understand perfectly. And then later, in the same incident, Skipper of Tingari, Fred, I believe the collision took place before the preparatory signal for both our divisions. Skipper of Brigadoon, I believe you are correct, John. Skipper of Tingari, in that case, we were not racing and I won't have to protest you. Skipper of Brigadoon, thank you and good luck.
Yes.
Well, sums that, up but, the amateurs,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, there's a fair amount of tongue-in-cheek in there. But the other occasion that I remember well was the woes of Warana that was written up. And this was a day when I think we'd been to Manly. We were coming back down the harbour and we were going to launch the spinnaker again. And it slipped off the bow and went underneath the boat and started to fill. And the spinnaker pole was bending back and back and back further and further. And I'm thinking, oh, just break, you know, otherwise it'll take the mast out. And it did. And then we managed to get all the bits and pieces and the spinnaker back in and we continued on. We were leading at the time, but we'd swell back a couple of places. And then working our way back to the finishing line, another boat, he was short-handed and we're coming into the finishing line on a starboard tack and he's coming across on port. And I called out and he failed to give way. And his bow rose up over and Bernadette was sitting in front of me. His bow became between me and Bernadette and took out the things, did a whole lot of damage to the knees and inside the boat. We locked together, pirouetted round, came apart like a couple of swans, and then I thought, well, I should still try and finish. So I came back round and was just straightening up and Nick Cassim's coming across. And I thought, oh, no, I don't know whether Nick's seen me or not. And at this stage, I was starting to lose confidence, you see. And
yes.
So I started to luff up. But right at that moment, Mr. Christian was going past and he struck me a glancing blow. Nick saw me at the last minute, went about. His sheets got caught round the Sampson post. And he got locked in irons and he drifted all the way down the finishing line and crashed into the side of the starter's boat.
So who bought the drinks back at the club that night?
Oh, well, we had to get Warana back up on the slips because it was taking water. Unfortunately, there was space to do that. And then Warana went round to Chowder Bay where Simon Sadubin did a big job on restoration of it. And in some ways, it was the major improvements were made, you know, to the hull and so forth.
What was the atmosphere after this demolition derby? Were there pleasantries being hurled around or was it...
As I wrote up the story about it and I said, I'm now writing this under heavy sedation from the North Shore Hospital. So I'd lost confidence and had to reach for the rum bottle, you know.
I had the impression that your boats have always been happy ships. Is that how you think your crews would see them?
They've stayed with me a long time. Most of them are 10 or 15 years, one 35 years. Harvey was with me for 25 years. Bernadette, gosh, I don't know, 15 years. It is, it's fun. You know, you've got to make it fun. And I mean, you like to win, but it's not everything, you know.
I know you were very, very pleased with yourself when you won your second Kelly Cup.
Parading
around as club champion, and some of us have never let you forget it, but obviously the crew got a buzz out of that.
Oh, they did, yes. It's a highlight. This year, sadly, the Classic fleet is dwindling somewhat. A couple of the boats are finding it difficult to get enough crew. So it's Not quite as competitive some boats which you'd normally expect to put a spinnaker up. Hard doing it this year.
There's only been four skippers in the 150 years of the Amateurs who won the Kelly Cup three times. Is Fred Bevis still aiming for that third
of
Kelly
course.
Cup?
Absolutely.
And when might this happen?
Oh, I hope this year.
So, Fred, with your racing successes, we turn to the matter of the handicapper. There are those at the club who never complain about the handicappers, and there are those who never stop complaining about the handicappers. What's been your experience of handicapping at the club?
Well, I think it's just a black box where random numbers come out of, and for that reason, I've never worried too much about it at all. I puzzle at the results. Sometimes adjustments are made which seem incomprehensible, but at the end of the day, people are trying to do their best and get in my view.
So you never towed a bucket behind the boat in the first couple of races of the season?
No, I'm usually wanting to win each time, yes. It's been interesting over the years, you know, the various changes in the methodology. It used to be 3 minutes for a win, 2 minutes for a second, 1 minute for a third, and then the computer came into play where it was...
Is the computer smarter?
If it's very cleverly programmed, it can take a lot more things into account. And I think, in what I understand from the work that John McClurkin has done on the handicapping system, it is looking at elapsed times over known lengths of courses and wind strengths and so forth. And it rates boats, a lot of depth in its averaging. Look, I think the fun is going out to competing, really, you know, and you can...
I know Bill Gaylor was thought that the best way the handicaps would work would be that everybody had at least a win or two in a season, and that was what drove Bill's handicapping. Very noble. Do you share that sentiment?
If the handicapping system is okay, you should just let it fall the way it falls. If it's a good handicapping system, everyone should have a chance.
And the fleets wouldn't be coming back if it wasn't.
No. So I think just leave them alone and get on with it. I've just been sailing a long time. It's not many people who have sailed 44 consecutive seasons.
Well, over that time, Fred, you've also rubbed shoulders with a few characters at the Amateurs. Who stand out in your memory?
I think Bill Merrington is a guy that I used to enjoy. He's had a number of wonderful old sayings. One of them was, you know, when there'd be some tricky thing coming up at a board meeting, he'd say, I think we've been round this boy before, you know. And as he aged a bit, because he was on the board for 50 years, if I remember correctly, I used to pick him up on the way to the board meetings. And he had a tremendous amount to do with bringing the Amateurs to that newer home there, along with Nick Cassam, I think, that did a lot of work on it as well. Peter Garrow, I thought, made an enormous contribution into introducing twilights and the energy brought to that, and it brought another round of people and enjoyment into it, and it's led from that to a wider range of sailing opportunities in the club, where once it was only Saturday afternoons, now it's Friday nights, sometimes weekday evening races, Sunday racing. Fleet sizes are down, but I think that's the sign of the times. So they're not alone there, but there's still a lot of opportunities to get out and sail. Who else is in the club? Well, when I first met Brian Woods, he was Commodore and shanghaied me into being treasurer on the first night that I got to the club, and took me off to see Forge, the auditors.
You mentioned earlier the collaborative strength that the club has, and that brings to mind self-help and working bears and names like Bob Lawler and Trevor Koch.
Oh, yes. Well, Bob was the sort of a version of Trevor Koch, but in a very different way. Bob was a bit more abrasive in some of his approach to things.
Compulsory volunteering
and all of that sort of thing. Every Commodore had their own personality and things, you know, that John Jeremy was always very, you know, straight and ordered. David Willis, for the short time he was on, was Wordy Willis was able to keep a meeting going longer than anybody else that I ever could possibly remember. John Rickard, many people may remember John, but he was very much involved in the installation of the first pontoon, and he did a lot of work with at that time. I remember some of the resistance to putting in the first pontoon from members up the river. Well, they said, well, what benefit will we get from this? You know, if I'm up the Langcove River and so forth. And this is just for those people who are in Mossman Bay. And
it's hard to imagine the club without a pontoon.
It is. But there was a way of fixing it because it helped me as treasurer in a couple of ways, because it allowed me then to revise the scale of charges for mooring fees and so forth on the basis that there was an added facility being provided that had to be paid for, and it gave me some movement to bring the fees more in line with the commercial realities of the time. And the other thing was to swap swing moorings for fore and aft moorings, which was a proposition that Maritime at the time wanted to do in the secluded parts of Mossman Bay. So that may have given us another 20 or 30 moorings.
All generating revenue.
Well, members and ongoing revenue. So it did two things. It cemented the membership base, and over the years, more and more of the clubs up the river have started their own racing and so forth. Greenwich is doing it and so forth. And that trapped all the boats in Woodford Bay, which once came to sail with the amateurs. They're no longer there. Amateurs has evolved more into a Mossman Bay-centred club.
So that volunteering and self-help and so on has been quite crucial to not only strengthening the value of the club on the books, but also to keeping it an attractive place to belong to.
It's been absolutely integral in the club being such a great place as it is now. We all know what the work of Trevor Kosh has done over the years, immeasurable. Enormous amount of money, we'd say. Someone like Louise Sullivan, who did some work for us to see how we should decorate the internal club. And she, that was her field. And she came down with a storyboard and colours and things and gave us a choice of a number of chairs. And the carvers were one of the options in it. But they were about, in those times, about $300 a chair, which was a lot of money.
So the club's changed quite a bit in your 45 years, for the better.
Yeah, for the better. Peter Garrow decided that members could buy a chair and put their name on the back of it. And suddenly, it didn't cost the club anything for the chairs. I remember she said, oh, look, little as possible, just reinstate the white dado line, which was the white line at shoulder height around the perimeter of the club and down at the floor level. The lights are okay, some new tables and these chairs and it'll all be okay. And that's about all we did, you know. But people say, oh, you can't afford it. And I said, oh, well, yes, we can. They said, when? I said, but not all in 1 year.
Well,
and
this is another form of donation, isn't it?
Yes, you just need to give me some more money.
Were there any revenue-raising proposals that got knocked on the head that the club wouldn't do? For example, there are no poker machines at the club.
No, we always regarded that as one of the great virtues of the club. We also thought it a virtue not to have a full liquor licence because it would complicate the operation of the club a lot more than it might otherwise, and the current arrangements seem to have served us well over the years.
Another feature of the club has been the numbers of families, in some cases almost dynasties, that have been at the club over 150 years, which turns me to your family. Your late wife, Beverly, was a member. Your two boys, James and Peter, both champion sailors in their own right, are members. Did the club bring your family in, or did...
It had always been part of our married life, you know, that I was almost from the day married, or very shortly after. And I was a member of the amateurs and then treasurer, so it just became part of family life. The boys loved sailing. They took up Sabo sailing in the Lane Cove River, and then moved on to lasers. Jane's left school fairly early, worked for Ian McDiarmid as a sailmaker for 10 years, then talked his way into Macquarie University and turned himself into a geologist. Don't know how that happened, you know. As I tell him, there must have left the standards slip enormously for him to have got through. Then goes on and gets a master's in geology at New South Wales. Peter did an apprenticeship in cabinet making, worked in the buildings. He talked his way into Western Suburbs University, then did a master's at Sydney in architectural building design or something, and in the meantime sailed in about six Flying Dutchman championships around the world.
And I seem to recall that on one memorable occasion, your wife Beverly beat you at the Australia Day Regatta.
I do not wish to discuss this matter.
Well, perhaps you could tell us about it.
Oh, if I must. It was after Gaffer's Day that John Buas had Tia here up on the slips down at the club. It had just been resurrected from the bottom from maybe the fifth or sixth time in his career.
It did
once about it did, by Trevor Crosh, I think, and crew.
Jim Lawler.
And Jim Lawler, when it sank somewhere near Shark Island in some twilight race. And it was up on the slips. It had sunk on its mooring at the top end of Mossam Bay, being lifted up. And John Buas was wanting to sell it, understandably, in hindsight.
And he couldn't believe his luck.
That's right. I mentioned, I said to Bevy, you have a look at it. Lovely old thing, you know. And I remember looking at Cooter boats and that from my father taking me down to Queenscliff to see them when he sailed the Williamstown punts in those years much earlier. I said to Buas, how much do you want for it? So we settled on $3,000. I was robbed. And then we didn't do much with it for a couple of years, and then came back from an overseas trip and had lined it up for Simon Sedouman to get it going for the upcoming Australia Day Regatta and the Gaffer's Day. So Beverly took it out on the Australia Day Regatta with her two sons and a couple of other fairly handy... A crack crew they were, yes, with Bob Langman, I think.
No, Bob Langley.
Langley, that's right, Bob Langley and Lindsay Brown and so forth. Anyway, they set off. I set off in Warana and...
Came second.
Came second, yes. And she dined out on it forever on that. It was great fun. She's got a name on the Lord Mayor's mug, which is a trophy that goes way back into the 1870s, as I've recently found doing the archives in the amateurs there. Then I, the year before, the Lord Mayor's mug, and I sent James out this last Australia Day Regatta to win it so we could have three Bevis's names on the mug. And the silly bugger lost to Gordon Ingate
came
by
3 seconds,
came second again.
There's another delightful family story. Your son Peter, his first boat was a Williamstown punt. And in your house in Lane Cove, there's a photograph of a Williamstown punt from 60, 70 years ago called Colleen. It was sailed by your father.
100 years ago, actually.
100 years ago, I'm sorry. Sailed by your father, and there was your son building and sailing a Williamstown punt in the Gaffer's Anniversary Regatta, Gaffer's Day.
Yeah, the 125th anniversary.
How did that Colleen 2 come about?
My son was doing his HSC, and one of the subjects he's doing is called Design and Technology. In my day, it would have been called Woodwork. We were down in Melbourne for a laser championship, both Peter and James, and we called in to see a distant relative who's the son of a man who my father used to sail against. And that was Cliff Gibson, and his father sailed against my father in these Williamstown punts, and he had a lot of photographs of them. And we talked about a project for Peter in his HSC, and we decided this would be it, and we drew up the lines for the Williamstown punt, and Hunters Hill High School provided us with a wire cage between two buildings, a padlock, and gave us access of an evening to go and work on it. And that's when he built a full-size replica of Colleen. James, with the help of Ian McDiarmid, made the sails. John Sturrock provided the paintwork. Sean Langman provided Prentice to help him wrap the aluminium mast in carbon fibre and do a few things like that. And he put it all together and got it on exhibition in a powerhouse museum and then sailed it in the 125th anniversary regatta for the club. And I think probably he would have been the youngest member of the club to have ever sailed his own built boat.
And I presume he passed his school test in this particular
subject.
We got
98 for that, but barely made double digits
overall.
We got
98.
Yes, I got 98.
So after 150 years, Fred, how do you see the club placed? What's its future?
Well, I think it's at a bit of a crossroads. We've always put heavy weight on traditional timber older boats. As time goes by, there are fewer and fewer of these boats. Not many people now want to take on the ownership of a timber boat. So that presents a number of challenges for the club into the future. It will remain strong as a home for those who love timber boats.
But the members aren't getting any younger either.
No, and Nick Cassam not out as regularly as he once was in Lolita. Graham Nock is now no longer out there in Caress. These were stalwarts of that thing. Vanity, for a variety of reasons, is not as regularly out there as the past. Varuna we see now as with pressures of family and time available is not out on the water. Beautiful boats. We still see Murray in out with his beautifully varnished ones, which I'm always picking up flaws in. So there's a core of boats, but I think it'll be a transition for the club. And I'm not sure how that will work, but there's a strong membership base. We're bringing in different sorts of membership. I think that seems to have gone quite well. It's been managed well. I think Bruce Dover did some excellent work in reorganising the structure of the club and brought through what might have been difficult changes, but eased them through in a very professional way.
And it's less of a male bastion than it once was.
Yes, yes it is, and that's good. So they're the sort of things I see as the challenges. I think the nature of the boats is going to be less and less timber boats. It's just inevitable. When's the last timber boat been built? Wouldn't been one built after 70, would there? Only a couple. I think there's one more Ranger being built at the moment. Vanity would have been a relatively recent one.
But nowhere near enough to keep fleets sustained.
No. Our gaffer's days are always great advertising for that part of the market, for the club. And people say, oh, they cost us, but they don't cost us. They secure and underpin.
You've belonged to the amateur for nearly a third of its life. What has it meant to you?
Well, it's a way of life in that respect. It's been my relaxation. It's been my counsellor in terms of being able to get away from work and go sailing and clear your mind of everything else rather than sailing. So it has been a source of great friendships, you know, both through crew and other people that I've met through the club. And it continues to be, and it seems to be flowing on through both sons who are keen sailors. Peter is using Marana to take his family out and stay on board it. James occasionally steers it, you know, when I can't get out. He and his wife take it out on Christmases up to Pittwater or another thing. So it's being used as a family boat, and there are all sorts of family involvement, as it turned out. Beverly owning Tia here. And
you've put a lot into the club in your 45 years as a sailor, as an administrator, and as a, dare I say it, bon vivant. Thank you for submitting yourself to this interrogation. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.